Welcome to the America Magazine podcast. America Magazine is the national Catholic weekly. Visit us online at www.americamagazine.org.
Hello and welcome to the America Magazine podcast for the week of October 15th. This is Tim Reedy, online editor of America. I'm joined this week by Matt Malone, Jesuit scholastic from the New England province. Welcome, Matt.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. Matt is here to talk this week about our editorial on Iraq and the prospects for success in that country. Now, this editorial is called A Diplomatic Surge. Matt, what do the editors mean by this term?
Well, I think what they mean is bringing to bear as much leverage as possible on the various parties in Iraq to bring about national reconciliation and a lasting political settlement.
Now, the editors write that political reconciliation is possible in Iraq. Now, with all the, you know, the news stories we see on the television, that doesn't seem realistic. But what must be done to have political success in Iraq?
Well, the issue is that although we've had some modest military successes, as outlined by Petraeus' report, we are in fact losing the war in Iraq, and that is because it requires a political solution, not a military solution. And on the political front, we have not made as much progress as we need to have made. Chief among the things that need to happen in Iraq in order to achieve a political solution is this business of national reconciliation. And that means moving toward a kind of non-sectarian governance, amnesty for former enemies, particularly former members of Saddam's Ba'ath Party, who, by the way, are desperately needed to run the state's bureaucracies, and most importantly, a meaningful oil revenue sharing law. Now, credibility is the currency of politics, and the United States is running a deficit right now in Iraq and in the region, and so we need to borrow the credibility of others in order to create leverage for the various parties in Iraq to move. That points us toward a diplomatic initiative, a diplomatic surge. Now, the issue is because, you know, in Iraq itself, arriving at that eventual political settlement is largely going to be the work of the Iraqi people. Right now, they're not really being challenged to arrive at that lasting solution. And so there are ways in which we can borrow the credibility of others and leverage the authority of others to pressure them to arrive at a solution.
Right, but so that's what you mean by others. You're talking about the surrounding countries.
Exactly, right. So, you know, all of those surrounding countries have credibility and pull with one or more factions in this fight. We need to pressure them to pressure the various sectarian elements in Iraq.
And this means Iran, Syria, you know, two governments who we have not gotten along with in the past.
Well, most particularly Iran and Syria,
yeah.
Right? But, I mean, also, you know, the Arab countries, Saudi Arabia, and so forth. But most particularly Iran and Syria, that's where we're going to have to spend a lot of our energy. We cannot arrive at a lasting political settlement in Iraq without talking to Iran and to Syria. Their destinies are intertwined, and, you know, they have a growing and frequently nefarious influence, as we say in the editorial, within the region, within the country.
Now, what we're really doing here is endorsing a lot of the propositions of the Iraq Study Group report, who they proposed a lot of this back in December, was it 06, I guess?
Mm-hmm.
Now, Bush did not take these up. Do you think it's possible that some of these proposals could be adopted now?
It's certainly not too late, although the window is closing. What is politically possible is largely up to the Bush administration. It hasn't shown a lot of willingness to, you know, engage diplomatically with the kind of intensity with which it is engaging militarily. And that's very unfortunate. But this administration has really misread the situation from the political, the economic, the social, the military situation from the very beginning.
Now, in our editorial, we do not endorse the immediate withdrawal that some Democrats are calling for or Bush's open-ended commitment. Now, is there a middle ground here, a timetable of some sorts, perhaps?
Yeah, what it requires, because what is ultimately required as a political solution, is to look at the readjustments to our military situation through a political lens, right? In other words, what can we do militarily by, you know, withdrawing some or redeploying others of our troops that will create the necessary momentum in order for people, you know, toward a political solution. I mean, one of the problems is because this administration has taken any meaningful redeployment or withdrawal of American troops off of the table until very recently, as we say in the editorial, the American military presence in Iraq has been neither a carrot nor a stick, right? It hasn't served as an incentive to anyone except, you know, the jihadists. And so, you know, we need to send a very clear message to the government that we are committed to a stable and secure Iraq, but at the same time, our commitment is not open-ended. You know, there needs to be a military strategy that is coordinated with this larger political strategy. In other words, we need to see, as I said, we need to see the any military readjustments we make as being in concert with, you know, our overall diplomatic and political strategy.
Now, of course, President Bush has said that we will withdraw some troops next summer, but of course, those are troops that would have to be redeployed anyway, because the army just isn't big enough.
Right. It's somewhat disingenuous, actually, of the administration to make that claim. I mean, people like Colin Powell have been saying as long as 2 years ago that meaningful forces, chunks of forces, like 30,000, would have to be withdrawn by this summer in order to maintain the functional integrity of the army.
Now, it seems like over the last few weeks there have been a number of articles in the mainstream press and in journals of opinion about Iraq and what our options are there. One major one was in The New Yorker by George Packer, where he explored the various avenues that we could pursue, one of which was the whole question of partition. Now, do you think that's a realistic possibility?
Well, I don't, you know, for the administration, that's been off the table. And I think, although we don't actually directly talk about partition in the editorial, I think it's consistent with the tone of the editorial to say that all of the options have to be on the table. I mean, there is a sense, we know this from press reports, that the Iraqi people are already segregating themselves from one another along sectarian lines. And so the question is, should we move toward a three-state solution or a three regions within one state solution? Those are questions largely for the Iraqi people, but the point is we don't have the leverage at the moment or the credibility in order to really move them toward reaching a lasting settlement. I mean, there are problems with the way that Iraq is currently configured, and I think actually Ambassador Crocker is correct. The Iraqi people are still sort of figuring out, you know, what their system of government is going to be. Those are not questions that are arrived at easily or quickly, but at the same time, they could be arrived at more easily and more quickly if the United States brought some pressure to bear on the various parties.
Yeah, I should note that in that New Yorker article, Packer, he's against partition because he believes it's unrealistic in that because, one, Iraqis are against it, you know, and it would not have the political support there, although that may change over time.
And I don't know about the credibility of those polls that say that.
Interesting. The other issue that he brought up was that even within Shiite communities or Sunni communities, it's not like that they're rallying around one another. There are various groups and sections within the Shiites and within the Sunnis. So it's not like if you just put them in one section of the country, it's just going to work out. You know, there could be, you know, intramural squabbling there. It's a very complicated situation.
I mean, the Sunnis and the Shias in this region have been at war with one another for 1,000 years. What seems to be the pipe dream is that they could live together, right? To me, it's an open question. As far as I can see, what's most important is that all of the options remain on the table. Where we're really seeing success in effective governing is in the regions right now, not in the central government.
Not in the central government,
right?
Okay.
It's really in the regions. And that actually came up in the Packer piece as well, and in the other reporting. You know, that is where we're really seeing the success in governance and in development. That does seem to suggest that, you know, there may be need to be some more serious devolution of authority from the central government to the regions.
Okay. Well, we've been talking about the October 8th editorial entitled A Diplomatic Surge. Now we're going to move on to talk about the October 15th editorial, which discusses the visit of President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad to New York and Columbia University a couple of weeks ago. Ahmadinejad was invited to Columbia by, I believe it was the dean of the international school there.
I think that's right, yeah.
And then the president was criticized for not overruling that decision, President Lee Bollinger. Now, what did you think about how Columbia handled this whole event?
Well, I think the America editorial got it right. I think inviting Ahmadinejad to speak and having him speak really is in the best traditions of a university and in the spirit of a sort of free academic exchange of ideas. But at the same time, I think it was, I think that the move by Bollinger to, for whatever reason, I assume it was internal politics, I don't know, but his choice to open up the discussion with this kind of invective and hyperbole was rude and at the least politically inept because it made Ahmadinejad a sympathetic figure, which is not an easy thing to do. I actually think I remember seeing Pat Buchanan on MSNBC shortly after that saying that Lee Bollinger ought to take Ahmadinejad ought to take Lee Bollinger with him everywhere he goes. It helps him look good.
Right, exactly. I mean, that was a lot of the sentiment here in New York, although the tabloids were very much, against the invitation. Most of the papers afterwards said Bollinger went too far. You know, if you're going to invite somebody there, your role as host is not to, you know, unleash a tirade against them. You have to be a little more gracious than that.
And that was Ahmadinejad's point, and he was absolutely correct in that. But I thought it was important that he come and that he speak and that he be allowed to speak freely, because this is one thing that this administration has not done well. And, you know, this is not an administration that likes to engage diplomatically. It does not like to engage in dialogue. It doesn't want to do the hard work of diplomacy. Its diplomatic strategies are much more bellicose and much more interested in unilateral interests rather than multilateral talks.
Now, an example of diplomacy on another level, not quite on the national level, but it was a meeting that was conducted by a group of Christians who wanted to meet with Ahmadinejad and talk about some common moral concerns. Now, among the participants in that meeting, which took place, I believe, in a church near the United Nations, was our own editor, Father Drew Christensen, who was the Catholic participant.
Right.
Now, there was a story about that in the New York Times. We mentioned it in the editorial. It seems like this gathering definitely had a different spirit than certainly what happened in Colombia.
I think it did. I wasn't there, but I did read the reports, and I did talk to a number of people who were there. And it would seem that it had a very different spirit. Although a number of the topics were revisited, such as Ahmadinejad's denial of the Holocaust or purported denial of the Holocaust.
This is what Father Drew Christensen has said in the past, is that it's difficult sometimes when you hold a meeting like this, is that you feel obliged to discuss these issues, but you only have a certain amount of time, and there are other important issues you want to cover as well. So after a certain point, you say, okay, let's put those things aside, you know, agree to disagree, as it were, and let's focus on the issues that we can at least, you know, make some progress on. Now, this is another question that is brought up in a piece by Peter Galbraith in New York Review of Books a couple weeks ago regarding reconciliation with Iran, and it doesn't seem possible now, but as he points out, it looked like it was a possibility back in 2003. When there was a effort on behalf of some members of the government to negotiate a deal with the U.S. where we would end our hostility, we would take them off the axis of evil, as it were, and they would agree to freeze their nuclear program. Mm-hmm. Now, it's a real sign of, you know, how far we've come or, you know, how far we've not come, that in 4 years that doesn't even seem possible.
Right. But I think, you know, in large measure, a reconciliation is not possible with Iran right now because of the disposition, diplomatic and otherwise, of the Bush administration. We refuse to back off of this bellicose rhetoric and really sit down to the table. And I think that because what's happening right now is that the Bush administration is pursuing two goals with Iran. One is trying to prevent it from becoming a nuclear power, and the other is regime change. And the two of these are often very much in conflict with one another. The only way that we are really going to move forward vis-a-vis the entire region is by sitting down and talking to Iran, because Gulf War II is over and Iran won. They are now the ascending power in the region, and that calls for engagement. If we can talk to North Korea, we can talk to Iran, and we have to. And Iran wants to. It really is in Iran's interest to talk to us. I mean, they'd rather sell their oil than sit on it. So an improved economic relationship with the West can only benefit them. But in exchange for anything that Iran offers, they're going to ask for a security guarantee, and meaning that the United States will not attempt to intervene militarily in Iran or to overthrow the regime in some kind of covert operation, as we have previously. And so far, this administration's unwilling to make that guarantee. I mean, one thing that we know, I think this was mentioned in the Galbraith piece, is that the actors, the democratic activists in Iraq, don't even want to be seen to be associated with us for the reasons we discussed earlier in this discussion, which is credibility is the currency of politics, right? And if you're seen to be associated with the U.S., you're not seen to be credible. Not because the United States is not a democracy, but because the United States has repeatedly interfered in the internal workings of Iran, overthrown its government and assassinated its leaders in the last century.
That's a real problem. Well, we'll end on that depressing note. Matt Malone, thanks again for joining us this week, and hopefully you'll come back again.
Okay, thank you.
This is Tim Reedy for the American Magazine Podcast. Thanks again for joining us. Tune in next week when we'll be discussing some fall TV with editor Jim McDermott. You can subscribe to our podcast by going to our homepage, americamagazine.org, and click on podcasts, or going to iTunes and search under American Magazine. We'd like to thank Bill McGarvey again for providing the music for this week's show. You can learn more about him at billmcgarvey.com. This is Tim Reedy for American Magazine.